Axel, yep. Brian and I have just arrived from Germany. We came by car, which was a mistake because we had to put up with Brian's music all the way, which is rubbish, by the way. Billy Joel seems to be a favorite thing. Axel, part of the game is you have to take us out for dinner. Now you're in. We came by car, but we forgot that you moved from Amsterdam to London, so we had to get the Eurotunnel, which took even longer. Of course, you're working now at the Royal Free, which is terrific. Do you want to talk us a bit about what we... In fact, why don't you talk about dinner we had last night together, or two nights ago, Axel?
Yeah, that was actually quite good. I mean, for me, it was a surprise that things...
I know the places, Axel. Stick with me, you'll be fine out there.
I think that... Well, coming from Amsterdam, where things are more open at the moment.
Where are we going to dinner? Fun. That's what I want to know.
Yeah, actually, you've got to say where the place was. It's important, and what we had to eat. That's because you'd rather pick any place in London for dinner to take us out to. That's part of the game.
Well, then I would say I actually quite like where we were. It was Iberia, and we had some bruschettas, I think, tomato.
Good.
Yeah. That was great, sort of tapas, and much better than the usual stuff. You normally have some pastas.
I quite like those restaurants we go to. Listen, let's move on. Axel, small renal mass, are we in an era of PSA-itis where we're doing a whole series of operations on people who don't need it?
Yes, to a certain degree, I would say this is true. I mean, what we do know is that there is certainly an overdiagnosis at the moment. A lot of these small renal masses are detected.
How do you define a small renal mass?
And it's, well, normally just by its cutoff of 4 centimeters, that's internationally agreed. And there had been active surveillance studies. The most known ones are from North America, Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto, and a couple of other studies in the US. And so we're talking about, I think, a body of evidence of, I think, almost roughly 700, 800 patients, of which we know that they can be observed up to a certain time. The only problem is we also know that 20% of these patients do progress within the years.
So, actually, I have two questions. Surgery. One is that I know the growth rate, at least the numbers I remember, are sort of in the 2 to 3 millimeter a year on average for small renal mass. So my question is, are there known, if you're watching somebody with small renal mass, my understanding is that growth rate isn't that great of an indicator of progression to metastatic disease. Are there known indicators, is question number one, of when you should intervene? And question number two, is there something on a biopsy, a baseline biopsy of a small renal mass that would make you not observe somebody?
Yeah. First of all, what we do know, I think it's good that you bring this up. So this 3 millimeter threshold, which is very often mentioned, is a sort of average growth rate. If you look at the spider plots in these published series, then you can actually see that some of these tumors progressed very rapidly. Not necessarily to metastasis, but locally. So the general understanding is what we sometimes feel is because if lesions are very close to the cutoff, let's say we are talking about a lesion that is 3 centimeters in size and someone wishes to undergo ablation, and it gets more difficult above 3 centimeters, or it's close to the threshold of 4 centimeters, then certainly... these are things to consider if they progress. Then
I see. So that might be a trigger not to observe them if they're going to cross this threshold. Are there histologic? Yeah.
But it's just a very general, obviously, you have to
Are there histologic? I mean, you know, we would sometimes, if it's high grade, if it's sarcomatoid, I mean, are there,
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we do have some, for example, papillary type 2, if that's on biopsy, or a Furman grade 3 to 4, this is something I would be reluctant to observe.
Why are we better?
Again,
why
this
are we
is just gut
this,
feeling, you know, it's not something.
Why are we not? No, around the world.
You mean the Royal Free?
why aren't we better? This is a very grey discussion we're having. Renal masses are incredibly common. I sit through MDTs and we have 10 of these a week. How come, we know that must mean there are hundreds a week in the UK, thousands in Europe, tens of thousands around the world. Why are we having these grey discussions? Why have we not answered these questions properly? And what questions should we be asking?
I think basically because it's not so easy to do that. We had a meeting at the NCI in Washington as a sort of think tank. What would be the ideal study? How should it look like? All stakeholders were involved, patient advocacy groups. And at the end of these 2 days, we had an inkling of what we could possibly do.
Are you allowed to tell us?
It's very, very difficult. First of all, I mean, it's not rocket science. It's basically that first of all, it starts with the fact that it's not easy to randomize. It's because there's no equipoise. So colleagues and patients think differently about this topic. The best way forward would probably be a cohort-embedded study. Then the next hurdle you have to take is, what do you want to take as an oncological endpoint? You know, or as an endpoint, is it cost? Is it progression rate? Is it metastasis rate? If you really go for the hard oncological endpoints, you may be well set with a trial that takes you 10, 15 years. So we are in the same ballpark as with prostate. You know, like, has there ever been a randomized trial between prostatectomy and brachy?
Probably I was going to ask if there's other examples in other malignancies that have tackled this. I mean, you're right about prostate, except it seems like the active surveillance protocols are much better established in that disease.
Absolutely. And we also see that even taking biopsies for small renal masses, I think in the big centers around the world, that's a fact already. But in many clinics, this is not happening. And you may be aware of this JAMA surgery paper where they looked at health insurance outcomes from the last 6 or 7 years in the United States. So we're talking about 18,000 partials, and 30% of them, so 6,000 patients, have benign lesions. And you could definitely avoid this by taking a biopsy, but it's somehow there. I don't know of any other disease where we would go ahead without having to take a biopsy.
Let's move on. Let's move into robotic surgery versus laparoscopic surgery. I was under the impression 5 years ago that robotic surgery was going to be the global standard of care for patients or partial nephrectomy. Yeah, I hear different messages from different people and I read different analyses and different papers suggesting that the results for laparoscopic or open are about the same. Is that fair?
I mean, from an oncological perspective, probably yes. The recovery of patients and the comfort with which it's done is probably more in the area of the robotic and laparoscopic surgeries. Again, here, there is no randomized trial. I think that Intuitive wanted to do one, but the problem is so many clinics have now gone over to robotics that they consider it almost unethical to subject some of the patients to open surgery, let alone that some of the colleagues not even have the skills to do that open. That's another thing.
What's the most powerful data that you have for robotic partial nephrectomy?
What we do have is just the usual, you're also part of the European Association of Urology guidelines. We do these systematic reviews. You might criticize it for garbage in, garbage out. Most of these studies are retrospective, but they all point towards the same direction, that there's less adverse events, less post-operative complications, less blood loss.
From a surgeon's perspective, is it more fun surgery? Is it better surgery? Is it easier surgery? Is it less skilled surgery? Is it easier to why from a surgical perspective has the momentum been to change?
Well, I was trained in both. So I come from a background where I did open partials, and it is really much easier. You have to get used to the docking and undocking of the robot, obviously. But once you're there, you sit at the console, you can see things in 3D. You have depth of vision. You know exactly what you do. There's less blood loss. You have a very clear vision. And that is something that you're not very
often getting. And are robots and surgeons who are trained now ubiquitous across the UK? I don't know the answer in the US. I kind of assume so, but maybe not.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the coverage of robotic systems in the US is, I think, about 400, but there may be even more by now. So I'm talking about numbers okay. I heard 2 or 3 years ago. And no, that is pretty much established there. Even some other voices, but we are not knowing about the denominator, and therefore this has not been published. You may be aware of the New England Journal of Medicine paper in gynecology that some laparoscopic procedures suggest that the oncological outcomes are poorer. And I know that there's a group in the US who collects these data. We also have at the NKI when I was in Amsterdam, we occasionally got these cases where things went wrong. So you had intra-abdominal deposits when these patients were operated. And it's not always clear why that has happened. It's not always because someone cut into the tumor. And the other thing is we don't know how Axel, often that happened with open surgery.
Metastatectomy for metastatic disease, debulking, cytoreductive nephrectomy. You've done a huge amount of work on this over the last 10 years. What's your current position? There's been Sirtime, there's been Carmina, there've been retrospective analyses. Should anyone get an operation? And if so, who are they?
Well, to begin with, I still think that patients have low volume metastatic disease that you could observe, or where you as an oncologist would say, I don't have a reason to start immediately with systemic therapy. I think that is a no-brainer. These are still candidates for upfront cytoreductive nephrectomy. I don't want to say this is proven that they survive longer, but it's just simply you think you have a chance to avoid systemic therapy for some time. Whether that really is the case, time will tell. But Brian, you did a very similar study. I think a lot of these patients were metachronous, mm-hmm. so low-volume disease can be observed. All other patients, I think, who require systemic therapy, Carmina and Sirtime, both, I think, but Carmina was the stronger study, suggest here a proof of principle. I don't think we have to redo these studies each time, but that's also what we see now with the paradigm shift in systemic therapy. I think if you are intermediate and poor risk and you need systemic therapy, you have to start. And then the next question that comes up, and that is something that remains to be tackled, in my point of view, in studies, is it good then to do a deferred cytoreductive nephrectomy or only when it becomes necessary, which right. was also done in Carmina, don't forget that.
So actually, let me push you on that a little bit. Is there any patient who you would want to start on systemic therapy after a debulking nephrectomy that you would do it? I didn't ask the question right. So you said if you can observe a patient for longer, then that's a motivation. Is there any other motivation? Because I would still send patients yeah. with low volume disease, but that I'm going to treat afterward to debulking nephrectomy. Or I might not know, right? Yeah. They might have lowish volume, but I don't really know what's going to happen yeah. at the next scan. So I send them to nephrectomy, and then I see what their next scan shows, which might be growth requiring systemic therapy, if you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, but then I think that is still an option in SOFA, but then you as an oncologist are key in the whole decision-making process because you give them the chance of observing. But I think if you have clearly someone who has signs of progression, who has IMDC factors, maybe two, then I think it is better to start with them. You may be aware of this post-hoc analysis they did with Carmina when Arnaud Méjean presented it, I think at ASCO last year, where he said mm-hmm. that if you have IMDC one factor, that these may still be patients where
yeah, I'm nervous about a subset analysis of a negative trial. It doesn't show it's exactly. better, and then you go and find something. I mean, I guess patients who are randomized on Wednesday probably might have done better too.
It makes sense. Biologically, it makes sense, right?
Yeah, but the danger of it biologically making sense. So we throw out the result of the trial because biologically it makes sense. I'm nervous about that approach.
Throwing out the results of the trial. Yeah. Right. Okay, I think patients with one or two risk factors who are intermediate are candidates. I think poor risk, no.
I accept that there are very careful, with very careful selection, if you go into that intermediate risk group with anemia or whatever it might be, whose tumors may or may not be growing fast, who may have a huge primary tumor with relatively one or two lung metastasis, I agree that could be a debulking nephrectomy up front. My nervousness about that is that we're trying to, the paradigm shift needs to change from everyone gets a nephrectomy into we should only be doing nephrectomies on those who are being carefully selected. And that's my concern. But
that's always been true, right? We should have only been doing it on carefully selected patients. Yeah. That, to me, that's what Carmina says, which I think we already knew. I'm not making fun of the study. I'm just saying it reinforces that, right? That
Well, I mean, the pity is that, that serotonin is underpowered, but what we found there is a 17-month survival difference, which, well, theoretically, the study is underpowered, but it cannot just be explained by pure chance. So I think there is an element in there that if you start with surgery and you need control of the disease, that some patients just do poorly.
But those are likely to be your multiple risk factor, poor risk patients, right, who shouldn't have been selected in the first place.
I mean,
Yeah, I would disagree. I mean, in SirTime, we had a completely different inclusion criteria than in Carmina, which also made the study so difficult to randomize, to accrue. So we used the MSKCC criteria. Mm-hmm. There needed to be intermediate risk. And then on top of that, to have no more than three of these factors that were published by the MD Anderson group, CULP. So no bulky disease, no bulky lymph nodes. And yet,
I'm going to take this opportunity to disagree as well. So I actually think your study, which I was involved with from a distance and was a cheerleader from the side, it was a shame it didn't recruit better because it did ask an important question. I feel that actually giving systemic therapy and getting in the control of disease first is really important. We've had surgery for 20 or 30 years, and median survival of metastatic renal cancer was 12 months until we developed the systemic therapies. And as we move on, my nervousness around doing a debulking nephrectomy is if one in three or one in four or one in five patients don't get to start systemic therapy because of the time taken and complications associated with a nephrectomy, then we're doing these patients a disservice. I'm much more comfortable with, if these patients need systemic therapy, I'm much more comfortable with just starting the systemic therapy and then having a debate about the nephrectomy as time goes by. With the new combinations with axitinib and pembrolizumab, we are getting in control of the disease in over 90%? I think it was about 10% primary progression rate. Mm-hmm. In 90% of patients, we're getting control of disease. Why on earth would you want to spend the next 6 weeks planning, doing a nephrectomy, waiting to recover, and taking that risk? It makes no sense to me.
Well, I mean, it should never be that like one in three, one in four don't make it to systemic therapy, right?
But that's the reality. That's the reality of the trials.
Oh, I don't think it's 30. It's not one in three that don't make it. It's at least therapy.
No, I mean, we had some, I think in the immediate nephrectomy arm, 20% of the patients.
So 20, not 30. Okay, call it 20. I'm happy with 20. One in five. Listen, Brian, we've got a last question, and I think we're running out of time. We're going to talk about the URTC and all sorts of bits and pieces, but I think this has been terrific. And we're not going to talk about the URTC, so we're going to invite you back to talk about that another time. I am really keen on the last question, which is around metastatectomy. Should we be performing in patients with metastatic disease? Should we be cutting out metastatic sites? Let's just start with which patients do you think where, let's talk about metastatectomy in the lungs to start with, where, what would be reasonable in your opinion?
I think all we have again here is retrospective series, and the, what makes these series even poorer than anything else is that they were comparing those who would be candidates for resection with those who never were, you know, with patients who had multiple metastatic disease or were in a poorer condition. So that is almost a given that the group that underwent metastasectomy had better results. Now, the other thing, what I'd like to take as a selective criteria is time. I sometimes try to discuss with patients before I take the decision. First of all, I look at the metachronic interval. Then once it pops up, I give it another 3 months for observation. And you also have to look at the initial risk patients had. So I think if you had that's what we know from the RECUR database, all those patients who underwent metastasectomy in recur and who had a Liebovitz high risk to begin with, all of them recurred again. You know, so I think just this idea of taking metastasis out to cure the patient,
Brian, what's your take
most
on it?
Of the time. And the only reason for me to do that would be to postpone systemic therapy. But again here, Brian, because of your study, you might as well.
There's overlap.
It doesn't mean
patient
you have
selection
to.
Is absolutely so critical. You're right. Some you can observe. I've done less metastasectomy and more, say, SBRT, same concept but different modality lately. But there's definitely an overlap between observing them, SBRT, and starting systemic therapy for sort of slowly progressive disease, right? There's an overlap there. And I've gone back and forth, you know, in the approach. But I definitely think there's a role. Even if you're deferring systemic therapy, you know, for how long is the question? Is it worth it to defer it for 6 months? Probably not. You probably could have watched that patient for 2 years. Yeah, probably. So I think it's a matter of degree.
Yeah. I completely agree, and I also tend to apply much more of these other focal therapies that are less invasive. So if the option exists, I wouldn't go in, because I think having another general anesthesia and surgeries is for something that might progress rapidly or come back.
Agreed. I'm glad we've ended on a note of agreement, I just want to say.
I actually was going to struggle. I'm not going to say anything.
I feel better. I feel better about myself.
So we're gonna go to that
Spanish one, Axel. We're up for it. Look, we're gonna go to the United States of America. I think we may pop via France. It's possible, but rumor has it, Brian, we may be on our way to Boston for a final leg.
Sounds good.
Axel, I know the way from the Royal Free to Heathrow. I know the way from Heathrow to Boston. So it's something I'm very familiar with. Axel, looking forward to seeing you next week. Brian, thanks a million. See you soon.
All right, thanks, guys.
Okay. Thanks. It was fun. Bye. Bye-bye.